Leslie Griffiths. Meanwhile, here on FM, our Book of the Week and more missives to and from a president. Questions arising from the nuclear arms race make up much of his later communiques, and then there's that fateful trip to Dallas in the letters of John F. Kennedy.
As the missile crisis escalated, Kennedy received a series of angry telegrams from the renowned British philosopher Lord Bertrand Russell.
"Your action desperate. Threat to human survival. No conceivable justification. Civilized man condemns it. We will not have mass murder. Ultimatums mean war. End this madness."
Kennedy's reply to Lord Russell was marked by a pointed admonishment.
"While your messages are critical of the United States, they make no mention of your concern for the introduction of secret Soviet missile weapons into Cuba. I think your attention might well be directed to the burglars rather than to those who have caught the burglars."
On October 28, 1962, in his letter to Khrushchev confirming the settlement of the crisis, Kennedy's statement, "Perhaps now as we step back from danger, we can together make real progress in this vital field," referred to nuclear disarmament, an issue he had felt passionately about since his days as a senator. When the Soviet Union had resumed its testing in 1961, Kennedy ordered the Defense Department to create materials to prepare Americans in the event of a nuclear attack. He asked his trusted advisor, John Kenneth Galbraith, to review one of the first of these materials. Galbraith's assessment was far from positive.
"November 9th, 1961. Dear Mr. President, fallout protection. Want to know about nuclear attack. What to do about it. There is a right and a wrong way to discharge our responsibilities, and this pamphlet represents, I fear, the wrong way. I have five specific objections. 1. The pamphlet does not make clear that it is American policy to avoid a Holocaust. Civilian defense represents contingency planning, with the word contingency strongly underlined. As a government, we hope and indeed intend to save our people from this disaster. This is not made clear in the present pamphlet. 2. The present pamphlet is a design for saving Republicans and sacrificing Democrats. These are the people who have individual houses with basements in which basement or lean-to fallout shelters can be built. There is no design for civilians who live in wooden three-deckers, tenements, low-cost apartments, or other congested areas. I am not at all attracted by a pamphlet which seeks to save the better elements of the population, but in the main, writes off those who voted for you. 3. The rest of the social philosophy underlying this pamphlet is equally offensive. While maintenance of an army and navy and their protection in case of an attack are well-recognized functions of the state, the protection of the civilian is herewith assigned to private enterprises. This is on the theory that the civilian is too expensive a luxury to protect. The pamphlet even makes a virtue of this by saying, "The anticipation of a new market for home shelters is helpful and in keeping with the free enterprise way of meeting changing conditions in our lives." 4. I also worry a little bit about the effect on the Soviets of a great helter-skelter shelter program such as this pamphlet could set off, and with all the commercial publicity attached. Isn't it a rather ostentatious form of war preparation? I think we are also likely to set off a certain amount of racketeering on people's fears. 5. Finally, and perhaps a minor point, it seems to me that the pamphlet is extremely sanguine, both about life in the shelter and the world into which people emerge. The latter will be a barren and hideous place with no food, no transportation, and full of stinking corpses. Perhaps this can't be said, but I don't think the people who wrote this pamphlet quite realize it. Sincerely, John Kenneth Galbraith.
The resumption of Soviet nuclear testing engendered widespread alarm among disarmament activists, who were not only outraged by the Russian action, but fearful that Kennedy would be compelled to respond in kind. Most vocal was Linus Pauling, the distinguished American scientist.
Are you going to give an order that will cause you to go down in history as one of the most immoral men of all time, and one of the greatest enemies of the human race?
Despite the more temperate pleas from nuclear test opponents around the world, including famed theologian and medical missionary Dr. Albert Schweitzer, Kennedy felt he had no choice but to order the resumption of American testing. To Dr. Schweitzer.
It was a tragic choice, and I made it only because the alternative seemed to me to offer even greater dangers to, or hopes for, world peace, to unborn generations to come, and to the future of humanity. I need hardly say that as the father of two children, I share your concern over the pernicious effect of radioactivity. I can only say that I had to weigh this against the alternative, that is, unlimited testing by the Soviet Union alone, leading to a steady increase in Soviet nuclear strength until the communist world could be ready for a final offensive against the democracies. I believe that the Soviet leadership includes men genuinely devoted to the cause of peace. Our strength reinforces them in their arguments with their extremist colleagues. It would seriously underline their position if their country were permitted to acquire decisive nuclear superiority.
April 1963. In one of his final communications with British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan, before a treaty was finally achieved, Kennedy asked the man to whom he addressed his letters with the words, "Dear friend," for a vital piece of advice: how to keep the French and German governments from creating a roadblock to the long-sought-after treaty.
Now that I am back in Washington, I want to thank you again for your kindness to me and to all my party at Birch Grove House. We packed a lot of work into a short time, and I think our meeting proved again how useful these sessions are. It was particularly kind of Lady Dorothy not only to permit our invasion, but to do so much to make everyone comfortable. Both dinner on Saturday and lunch on Sunday were meals of the sort that would make my wife ask if the cook would like to live in the United States. The big problem before us now is the mission of our two colleagues to Moscow, and I know our people are in closest touch as the work goes forward. I agree with what you said in the House yesterday, and I particularly agree that the most important thing at the moment is to try to keep our French and German friends from throwing any cold water in public. I have sent a message to the Chancellor trying to make this point quietly. What troubles me is that General de Gaulle may see nothing to his advantage in any agreement of the sort which may now be possible. And we are thinking hard here about possible ways of leading him to a less negative attitude. If you have any thoughts on this aspect of the problem, I should be very glad to hear them. With renewed thanks and warm personal wishes, sincerely, John F. Kennedy.
July 25th, 1963. Representatives of the United States, the Soviet Union, and the United Kingdom reached an agreement on a treaty banning nuclear testing in the air, in space, and underwater. It was an historic achievement. October 10, 1963. For the president, whose thoughts were turning towards re-election, the telegram from Khrushchev expressing his belief that the nuclear test ban treaty should become the beginning of a sharp turn toward broad relaxation of international tension could not have been more welcome. It would also be the last letter Kennedy received from the Soviet chairman. Kennedy and his top political advisers were now deep in preparations for the 1964 presidential campaign, an election that he looked forward to with confidence. With the election in mind, he chose to go to Dallas. November 22, 1963. At 12:30 p.m., John Kennedy was struck by two sniper's bullets and was pronounced dead at 1 p.m. At 46, he had become the youngest United States president to die. Did Lee Harvey Oswald act alone? If not, who was responsible for John Kennedy's murder? And even if Kennedy had not been assassinated, would he have lived long enough to complete a second term? To most of the world, Kennedy was the epitome of what he loved to term vigor, a model of glowing health and energy. It was a well-orchestrated lie. The public knew Kennedy had severe problems with his back, though they were never aware that he relied heavily on doses of drugs and pills. He needed 3 hot baths a day and spent at least half of many days in bed. What most never knew was that by the time he was 30, he had developed such a condition that as a congressman on a visit to London in 1947, he became so ill that he was given the last rites of the Catholic Church. The doctor who attended him diagnosed a failure of his adrenal glands, known as Addison's disease, causing weight loss, weakness, and gastronomical problems, an ailment so serious at the time that the doctor told one of Kennedy's friends, "He hasn't got a year to live." While the doctor's diagnosis of the disease proved correct, his timetable for Kennedy's demise proved to be wrong. But by the time he entered the White House, he was taking heavy doses of cortisone, orally and through injection. He also had another form of cortisone implanted in his thighs and replaced several times a year. There is evidence that the Kennedy family kept a supply of cortisone in safe deposit boxes around the country and overseas so that the president would have access to medication wherever he traveled. As one of his aides recalled,
"He used more pills, potions, poultices, and other paraphernalia than would be found in a small dispensary."
William Manchester, close friend and biographer, wrote,
"He lived with pain, though only those who knew him well could tell when he was suffering. This image was a triumph of will."
Colin Stinton was narrating The Letters of John F. Kennedy, which were edited by Martin W. Sadler and abridged for radio by Penny Lester. The other voices were Trevor White and Peter Marinka, and Richard Lang was John Kennedy. The series producer was Duncan Minchell. This afternoon here on Radio 4, you can hear the first in a series of 3 stories specially commissioned to mark the 50th anniversary of JFK's assassination in Where Were You When Kennedy Was Shot? Well, for most, TV and radio broke the news across the world, but for an Irish farmer, it came from closer to home. The Long Laneway by Colin McCann, this afternoon at 3:45.
When swimming the English Channel, you need 3 things. Dedication.
Well, there's a ferry there, so why would I want to swim the channel?
Determination.
Oh, that is freezing, I gotta get out right now. I haven't brought a towel either, that was a bit foolish of me.
And lots of support.
Most people that swim the channel are dreamers.
You are not giving up.
I never said I was.
Are you saying that quite a lot of them are delusional?
Half of all are delusional.
Jolyon Jenkins follows the long crawl to France. Catch up now at the Radio 4 website.
Oprah Winfrey joins Jenny Murray in Woman's Hour after the news.